Hey, Indie Filmmakers, I'm Nick Bodmer.
I'm Griffin Hammond, and on this week's episode, we're taking a look at some of the tech announcements at NAB that caught our eye, including the new Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 4K.
Plus, your questions about shooting for cinema screens, what frame rate to choose for editing, and if you should spend $1,000 on a microphone. Hey, Griffin.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
I am very well, sir. And how are you?
I'm good. Although, last year we were at NAB together, right?
Yeah.
In Las Vegas.
And now we're so far away from each other.
Actually, you're like just down the road from it, but you haven't had a chance to go, right?
I made it all the way to the parking lot of NAB, but not inside.
What were you doing there? Just work?
My company has a big presence there, and I was dropping somebody off after we had lunch.
Okay. But and I've been busy shooting some projects, so this year our only awareness of NAB is what we're reading online.
That's right. And I haven't been paying that much attention, so you're going to have to educate me a little bit.
Well, last week we talked about the new ProRes RAW format, which was kind of an NAB announcement, as well as the new Final Cut. And yeah, that was last week's show. But one of the big things that everyone commented on last week's episode was, what do you guys think about the new Pocket Cinema Camera from Blackmagic? In fact, that was a Twitter question I got here from Curtis Lamons.
Now, you have the original Blackmagic, right? You got that on, was that like a Kickstarter project? Am I making that up?
I don't think it was a Kickstarter, but it kind of had that feel, though. It was kind of a startup product.
I think. Yeah.
It wasn't Blackmagic's first camera, but it was their first, I guess, accessible to consumer camera. It was $1,000. It shot raw on a Micro Four Thirds mount, but I think it was actually a smaller sensor. It was like a Super 16 millimeter size sensor.
And that was the big draw, was like at that price point, raw was just unbelievable, right? And nobody could get raw at that price point until then.
Exactly. Yeah. And you could also shoot ProRes, and I think you could also shoot like a H.264 kind of compressed format. The funny thing is, I was excited to get that camera. It was, you know, to put it alongside my Lumix GH2 or whatever was out at the time that camera came out. It's been several years since that camera came out. But I probably only shot with it maybe under 10 times and just was never very happy with it, actually.
It just wasn't quite a fully fleshed camera in the way the cameras we use every day are.
I always felt like it would have been a great studio camera if it's plugged into power and you have time to get the shots and go through the settings. But as a documentary camera, it really failed me a lot because it had tiny little batteries that would only last maybe 20 minutes, sometimes 15 minutes. So I couldn't get through an interview with this camera. And it was really hard to use. Like, a lot of the functions, like ISO, were in menus. It was like you had to click several buttons just to change something like ISO. So actually, one of the first things I'm excited about seeing on the new Blackmagic Pocket Cinema 4K is that it looks more like a real camera. It has ISO button, white balance right on the top. It looks like maybe it's more user-friendly.
I haven't seen it. Is it like more SLR style than the last one too?
It does look kind of like an SLR. Here, you can click the link I put in the notes here, and you'll see the B&H listing for it. In a way, it looks just like a DSLR. It's a Micro Four Thirds mount.
A little stretched out, but...
Yeah. So the big deal about it is that it's going to shoot 4K 60p. It can shoot... Let's see. It could shoot ProRes at 10-bit, or it could shoot RAW Cinema DNG at 12-bit color.
Wow. Oh, and it's got a dual native ISO, too.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that. And it also has 13 stops of dynamic range.
Cool.
And it can do all this for an amazing price point. It's $1,300.
So you're going to get one? Try it out?
Maybe I will. I mean, it is an attractive price. It's significantly less than a Panasonic GH5. Although, I think just like with the original Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera, on paper, you're like, wow, it has all these features at that price point. That's amazing. And then when you get it, you realize you forget like little things it's missing. Like, I'm sure there's things I haven't thought about that the GH5 does really well that are not in this camera. But if your concern is shooting RAW, then this is a great camera to get.
The menu and interface are the same ones as found on the Ursa Mini camera. How's that? That's not something they make, is it?
It is.
It must be. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's a user interface improvement over the original Pocket Cinema camera. What also, if you turn this camera around, it just looks incredible. It has a 5-inch LCD touchscreen on the back.
Oh, nice.
So that's also an improvement, something that's more exciting over, well, the previous camera and like my current camera. I also like that it has a mini XLR adapter on it. So I guess, I don't know if it comes with this adapter plug, but presumably you could plug in all your XLR cables directly into the camera without the need of a recorder or an adapter.
That's actually like really cool.
A big adapter unit.
I've never heard of mini XLR, though. I wonder what that looks like.
I've seen it before, but I've actually never used it.
Oh, I see it. It looks like an XLR, but mini.
Yeah, just tiny, yeah. Which makes sense. XLR does look like it's ridiculously big for what it is, those three
exactly.
pins.
Oh, and it's got USB-C, which is nice. Full HDMI out. Cool.
And the USB-C is interesting because I don't know, I guess I don't know what drives are compatible with this, but apparently you could be recording to an external drive over that USB-C interface.
Oh, that's neat. So if you're doing some really long recording or something, you can just plug in an external SSD or something.
Right.
Cool.
And that's a lot of the, you know, something to think about with this kind of camera. You know, when I go on like the GH5 user forum on Facebook, I see people, you know, this happens every time a new camera comes out. There's people going, oh man, the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema camera is a GH5 killer. How can I sell my camera right away? And, you know, people are arguing over like, no, you don't want that camera. But, and one thing you keep seeing people reminding others of is you wouldn't shoot a wedding in 12-bit color RAW. Like, you could, but you're going to fill up drives real fast. I think they said it's something like a terabyte per hour or something.
Oh, my gosh. That's quite the data rate.
Yeah, I can't even remember if I have that data rate right. But in any event, it's going to be a lot.
It's a ton of storage.
Yeah. So, specific kinds of shooting, I think, would benefit from this kind of camera. I'm also curious to see what the battery life is going to be like. It does look like the batteries are bigger than before. They're using Canon LPE6 batteries. I don't know how much it draws, but at least they look like they're probably higher capacity than the last camera.
Yeah, that's good.
So yeah, I'll have to check it out at some point. It looks interesting.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see the hands-on reviews when people actually get them in their little hands and get to play with them, and we can find out what those little problems are that might drive us crazy.
Yeah, so let's see. I have the B&H listing right now, and it says it's going to be available September 3rd. So it's still a ways away, but they made their big
announcement.
Usually
some reviewers will get their hands on it a little earlier, though. So I'm sure we'll find out. Just
I'm actually seeing in the picture here that looks interesting. I can't tell if this is a light or a button. It almost looks like there's a recording light on the front, too.
That red,
yeah, that little red line. What is that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
we're not
sure. So other cameras that were announced, some of these I'm not, are not in my price range. I'm not interested in. Like I noticed, Canon announced a C700 full frame camera, and you want to guess how much that costs? Like a cinema camera with a full frame sensor,
$30,000.
Yeah, it's $33,000 for the body.
Oh, I was right.
That'll work with EF lenses. Sony also announced a Mark II of their FS5, which is a $5,200 camcorder, 4K camcorder. But I think it was the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema camera that kind of
stole
the
show.
The news. Yeah. Panasonic came out with some firmware for the EVA 1. Which kind of ties into what we were talking about last week. The new firmware will let the camera do a RAW output over SDI, which I don't think it could do before this.
Okay, so then it could use one of those recorders to do ProRes RAW.
Yeah, I can't tell if the ProRes RAW compatibility is available immediately, but I did see that Atomos did a firmware update to their Shogun Inferno and Sumo 19-inch recorders to allow the EVA 1, you know, to be able to record the RAW from the EVA 1 over SDI. I can't tell, though, whether or not it can do ProRes RAW right now. I'm sure it will be able to. And then they also added the 400 megabit all I codec for the EVA 1, so if you want to.
That's the same that they've got on the GH5 now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, some new functionality there. Oh, and I should mention that raw output is actually coming out of the EVA 1. It's actually a 5.7K image.
Ooh.
Yeah. And like we were talking about last week, we were wondering if HDMI can support raw output, and we weren't seeing any cameras that could do it. And it seemed like maybe that's not possible, but some people were saying that, like the Atomos people were saying that HDMI could theoretically support it. I just don't know if
the new HDMI 2.1 I think has some pretty high bandwidth, so maybe it is just a data stream and they can jam a crazy codec or crazy bitrate through.
Did you see this thing about the Vimeo app? Vimeo released a new app for Mac.
Vimeo,
I think I got this email.
App?
Yeah, well, like a desktop app. And I was kind of curious, like, why you would even want this, because Final Cut already has Vimeo integration. You can currently share directly to Vimeo through Final Cut. So I wondered why you'd want this, but I'm a power Vimeo user. I upload a lot of stuff, especially in private mode for clients, to Vimeo. So I thought I would download it and take a look. And I was surprised to see that it's not like a full desktop application. It's more like a, like one of those little apps that lives in the taskbar.
Sure. What is it? Is it like for more detailed Final Cut integration?
Yeah, that's pretty much the only reason you would use it, I guess. In fact, if you're a Premiere user, I'm not really sure why you would need this, except that you can upload files directly through that little taskbar icon. But really, when you install it, it asks you for some Final Cut permissions. I think it just adds like a plugin to Final Cut. And one of the things now you can do is you could share through Vimeo like before, or now you can do share through Vimeo Advanced, and that's the new plugin. And I guess the big difference is now you could actually export ProRes to Vimeo. You could upload ProRes.
That's what I was going to say, is with the built-in Final Cut YouTube and Vimeo exporting, you don't get a lot of control over the export settings, right? It kind of has things picked for you.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you could only upload H.264 before. And I'm not exactly sure which settings you could control. Maybe there were some limitations. Now it seems like you can pretty much do everything you're doing on the browser. You could export ProRes or H.264. You could still choose all your resolutions, but I think you could do that before. But now you can, right when you're uploading, it asks you for a title and description and privacy setting. And it's
so it should
kind
speed
of
up your workflow a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even until I was exporting a test. I was still kind of thinking, like, why would I need this? I could still just go to the browser. Not a big deal. But it was kind of cool that the moment I hit export, that little taskbar thing popped up, and it showed me that it was exporting, and then it showed me when it was uploading. And I realized, because a lot of what I do is a private link, even right there in the taskbar, you can click a button to get that link. So I suppose if I was uploading several versions of something, or kind of going back and forth with a client, it could just be easier to never get on my browser.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's faster uploading somehow through an app instead of through the web browser. Maybe, probably not, but maybe.
I mean, it did seem like, I mean, I was doing a really short test clip, so I'm sure the encode didn't take very long. But I think just taking out some of the steps also just seemed like it sped things up a lot. It was like, oh, you're doing all the work for me. The last interesting product that I saw was Rode is releasing a new, like, it looks like it's kind of like for VR or something. They call it an ambisonic microphone.
I just clicked on it. It looks crazy in a very cool way. Holy cow.
Why don't you, for people that are listening, describe what this thing looks like.
All right, so you've got the standard long, thin metal mic capsule, but then sticking out of the top is a little sphere with what looks like four cylinders pointing off in various directions. It looks very, you know, sci-fi looking. It's cool.
Yeah.
So it's a 360-degree surround sound capture microphone.
And it looks like it's kind of reflective. It's not like matte black, but it is like dark. So hopefully it'll hide from your 360 shot. Or I imagine the idea is to put it maybe directly above your 360 camera. It's kind of a small profile.
Gosh, that's the problem with shooting 360 is everything's in view.
Right. Well, one trick is like if the sky is above you in 360, that's pretty easy to edit things out.
Right.
Or if grass is below you, and that's where you decide to put the tripod or the mic. Those shouldn't be too hard to clean up.
Yeah, I'm reading their press release now. It gives budding VR creators, immersive filmmakers, and video game world builders an accessible and high-quality way to dive into 360-degree with height audio capture.
I'm sure the technology must have come along in the last few years, but when I started shooting 360 maybe a couple of years ago, just playing around with it, everyone was always asking about ambisonic microphones, and it was kind of like, well, yeah, they exist. I could buy one, but right now, like, the platforms that we are publishing this on may not support surround sound audio in it,
right?
You know, in an ambisonic way where you move your head and it changes. So
how do you record this? Because you can't just record it. Is it just stereo, or is there more data than that being captured?
I imagine it's recording. Oh yeah, I guess I don't even know what's coming out of this thing. Is it an XLR cable?
Yeah.
Or yeah, I don't know exactly how this works.
Me either. Interesting. We'll have to find out. If anybody knows, let us know. We'd love to talk about that. How 360 degree audio is recorded and mastered and presented. I guess you can I don't know how you would do it. It's interesting. I wonder if there's four different audio tracks coming out of this thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would expect, yeah. So there's not a lot of details about this microphone. All they're saying is that it's coming out soon this year and that it's going to be under $1,000, which I guess is a big deal for ambisonic microphones. That seems to be what Rode is touting, their price point.
Oh, it says right here, 4-channel. Yeah.
Yeah.
4 channels get recorded.
But again, what does that mean? Is it a USB mic? Maybe it's not even an XLR. It's probably a digital output.
Yeah. All right, what else you got? What else from NAB? What do I need to know?
I don't know. Those were the things that stuck out to me. I'm sure there are other products that excited our audience even more than that. So let us know in the comments on YouTube if we missed something that you're really excited about coming to market. And then I'll ask Nick if he's excited about it.
Yeah. And the answer will be no, I'm not. Yes, I am. All right, do we got any questions today, Griffin?
Yeah, so our first YouTube comment from Taiga Permaculture is actually, what happened to the Ask Griffin segment that you came
what
up with?
What happened to Ask Griffin? Well, Griffin tried to kill it.
A lot of people asked about it because last week you skipped it.
Well, two things. One, we need more questions. So if you like it, ask Griffin a question. Hashtag Ask Griffin on Twitter. But we do have some, like this great question that Griffin ruined from Fireworks. Griffin, what is your favorite restaurant in Bloomington Normal?
Oh.
And then what happened, Griffin? What happened?
I answered it on Twitter because it was such a good question.
You answered it on Twitter. You can't do that. You ruined it. So that's it. I mean, Griffin tried to ruin it.
Griffin, what was your answer? Plenty of people haven't heard my answer yet.
Go ahead.
Although this is a very specific answer that won't resonate with most of our audience because they don't go to Bloomington Normal, Illinois. but this is where I used to live. This is where Illinois State University is. And I said that my favorite restaurant is probably Luca Grill, which is a Italian restaurant, really old Italian restaurant in downtown Bloomington. And they make some really great thin crust pizza called the Baldini. Have you ever had the Baldini?
I don't think so. I'm not sure if I've been to Luca Grill. I think I have.
This was a place that I didn't really discover how great it was until near the end of my like college education. But actually,
we
Luca
couldn't
is where,
afford it when we were in college.
It's not even expensive. That's what's funny. But it does like look like a nice restaurant. It's actually where I took Amy on our first date.
Oh, isn't that nice?
But I think even when we first went, we didn't know that you're supposed to order this amazing pizza they have. We ordered like spaghetti.
All right, to make up for the lack of an Ask Griffin last week, I've got one more for you. This is from Micah Pendleton. He says, Griffin, you've traveled to many places around the world with various cultures and cuisines. What is the most unique dish you've tried outside the United States?
I almost want to say bishbarmak in Kazakhstan, the horse and noodle dish.
Yeah, that's definitely
just
unique.
I love the name of it, and I love how excited Kazakhstanis are about it. It's actually not that weird of a dish. Like, it tastes pretty normal, but it tastes like pretty normal for an American palate. It's not that exotic, but they just love it there. In fact, I don't even think I told you this. There's a guy that wrote a bishbarmak song.
Bish, bish, bish.
And he made a video that like he wants to make a music video for this song, and he was explaining where the inspiration of making the song came from, and he shows a clip of me at the Go Viral conference I went to last year talking about bishbarmak.
I love bishbarmak.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So that was hashtag Ask Griffin. Hashtag. I need some more hashtag Ask Griffin questions, so hit me up on Twitter.
All right, now to our regularly scheduled filmmaking questions.
That's right.
We have an email from Austin, who is working with a director right now. They're talking about shooting a feature, and as they're starting to think about this, they're thinking, what kind of gear do we need if the point is to play it on a theater projector? Like, are there minimum requirements for resolution or frame rate or anything like that, or camera settings? Is there something we need to do to achieve that look that holds up on a big screen?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, it's a great question.
It's a great question. And I feel like kind of these days, the majority of most filmmakers' kit is probably good enough, wouldn't you think? Or do you think there's a minimum level of quality out there that is somewhat difficult to reach?
Yeah, it's funny because it's such a good question, and it's good that he's thinking about this, but I feel like my experience has been that, wow, the things I shoot, even when I don't think they're going to hold up, actually do look really good on a theater screen. Like, Sriracha is still playing in theaters occasionally when I take it around the world or a film festival invites me. And I have been struck by how many times I've watched it on giant screens. And this is a film that was shot in 2013 in 1080 on the Panasonic GH3. And it looks great on screens. So I think even 1080 looks really good on a theater screen.
Here's where I'm guessing things will start to break down. Like, if you're dealing with low light and high ISO, I have a feeling that's going to become very noticeable on a bigger screen, or at least more noticeable than on you know, YouTube or something like that. So I know when we shot Sriracha, that was something you really focused on, was getting nice, really high-quality light. We had fast lenses. You know, we brought a light kit when we had to shoot indoors and shot a lot outside. So I think that helps a lot, too.
Yeah, I mean, all the things that we talk about that are, you know, make things look like professional film. You know, if you're lighting things, if your audio is good, if you are using cinematic kind of shots. And yeah, I mean, if you're running around handheld with no light, it's not going to look good on TV or on the web or in a theater.
Have you noticed any difference is like in the audio mix compared to like when you're sitting at your computer with headphones on and then you're in a theater? Like, do you feel like you need to push voices a little harder or anything like that?
You know, it's like every theater is different, and I think the main thing I've noticed is that I think in some theaters, I think when they play it too loudly, I almost feel like my voice in the film is too loud, and maybe everything else is okay. Like maybe my voiceover needed to be louder for a lower volume experience. It needs to be loud enough to be clear and get the points across. But when they really pump the audio, you know, maybe I've gone a little bit too heavy on my voice, or maybe it's just because it's my own voice that it bothers me. But I also find that in theaters, when they play the film at like 75% of what I wish the volume would be, it's just a worse experience. Like if a movie's too quiet, people just don't react to it because they don't want to like interrupt it. So you get more laughs when the film is just 10% louder.
And do you ever have any input over that or not really?
No. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I wonder, if it's been too quiet, if they play it too quietly in a theater, part of me wonders, like, did I do something wrong? Was I supposed to, you know, I don't know, like, what's the standard of audio? But for the most part, it's been pretty good. But that's the thing, is every theater has been wildly different. I mean, some screenings are just bad because the audio system's bad in a theater or the projection's not very good. I mean, my film has been screened where it's, like, slightly out of focus because of the projector.
It makes you crazy, I bet.
I know. That's what I'd worry about more, is like you make a beautiful film and just sometimes it doesn't get shown right.
And you're finding that most of the places that your films have screened, they're not projecting in 4K or anything crazy like that, right? These are pretty much 1080 projection systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the theaters I've been to can do 4K. It's surprising how few of them do, at least like in the film
4K projectors
circuit.
Are extremely expensive.
Yeah, so even some still. I think maybe one of the theaters I've gone to with hand cut, and I think I've done like 9 festivals with that film, I think one was able to do it in 4K, and they definitely couldn't do 4K 60. They did it in 4K right. 30 or maybe 4K. Yeah, it was probably 4K 30. But then most of the theaters I've gone to are showing it in 1080, and I think maybe one of those was able to do, well, no, I don't even think any of them could do 60 and 1080. I think they were all 1080 30, which I thought was kind of funny. It's like they're showing like 1/8 of my film because they're showing half the frames and they're showing a quarter of the resolution,
the pixels.
But even then, it still looks really good. And even though my shutter speed might be a little bit too fast because I wasn't following the 180 degree rule for 30 frames per second, I was following it for 60. So my shutter's a little fast, we're only showing half the frames, and we're only showing quarter the resolution, but it still looks really good on cinema screens. So I wouldn't worry too much about your max resolution. I just maybe just get the frame rate exactly what you know the theater is capable of.
All right, we got another email from David who says, I was really impressed with the composite photos you had done of a puffin and eagle in flight using 4K. Is that difficult to do?
Not hard. In fact, I didn't even do photos per se. It really was just 4K video, because actually I know that I wouldn't have done that very well in burst photo mode. I just happened to have some video of a puffin flying around when I was in Alaska, flying over me. And so I just copied several stills. In fact, I think I just used QuickTime. QuickTime is really easy to just copy stills out of. Have you ever done that?
Oh, really? No, I haven't.
Just open up a video file in QuickTime. You can navigate to the frame. You can even click the left and right arrows to go exactly frame by frame. And then just hit Command C for copy. And you can paste that 4K frame into Photoshop.
Oh, that's clever.
So I just grabbed like five or six of the frames that looked really nice, pasted them all into Photoshop, kind of laid them out with an appropriate distance between them. And I think I did a little bit of like cutting and feathering around them so they could live on, these layers could be on top of each other without covering each other. And I also messed around with some composite settings to maybe let some of them blend into the other backgrounds, but really not a difficult thing to do.
Cool.
I suppose it's probably easier with video than with photos, if you're not too concerned about the resolution. We got a Twitter question from Matter Graphica asking about transcoding files for editing. We've talked about how sometimes I transcode into ProRes. Actually, I think I was talking about proxy. But he's wondering what software we use for transcoding and what format do you export when you're done with the project?
Well, I think, you know, for the actual editing process, we're just going to use Final Cut's built-in optimized media or proxy media tools, right?
Right.
I assume you do the same thing for your in-edit transcodes. But
yeah,
you do,
I mean,
do something a little different for your final exports than I do.
Well, if I'm doing, you know, if I'm doing proxy media in Final Cut, you can just right click a clip right there in the bin in the event and ask it to transcode it either to proxy or to optimized media, which I think we talked about in weeks past. I'm not usually transcoding to the optimized media, which is ProRes. But if you really were having trouble with your computer handling these files, you could always do that. But usually I'm going to the smaller proxy. And then when I'm done, you have to ask Final Cut to play back the proxy media rather than the optimized media or the original media. But then when you're done and you export, if you keep it in proxy mode, it'll actually export the proxy. So you have to switch back to viewing everything in original media, and then you export. And I usually export ProRes video because that's what I know the Final Cut is rendering as, and then I can just throw that into Adobe Media Encoder and turn it into the H.264 files that I need.
Whereas I use compressor, but I think maybe your way might be compressor seems to have some bugs sometimes, which is kind of frustrating, but that's
yeah,
what I use because I don't have Adobe.
Yeah, I'll run into errors sometimes in Compressor. I almost never have errors in Media Encoder. It's just a really stable piece of software. But as I think we've even talked about this in early podcast episodes when we were figuring out the best way to export the podcast. For such a long video like the podcast, it was actually pretty annoying to export the entire thing in ProRes, take up a lot of space on the hard drive, and then throw that whole thing into Media Encoder, and it takes another really long amount of time to transcode it. Whereas I find if I just do the straight share right out of Final Cut and it's making its H.264 file, it's not using compressor, but I'm sure it's using the same engine
same
as compressor.
Same code, yeah.
to write that file. It's just one fewer step, and I have not had many problems that way. Occasionally it's failed, but very rarely. So that works well for the podcast.
And you're not looking to keep a long-term ProRes archive of every podcast episode.
Yeah, I just don't need that. It's not a big deal.
Future historians may be upset when they have to crawl through our archives, you know, and they won't be as quite as high quality as it could be.
Right.
Hey, we've got a YouTube comment from Brian Burke. He says he's heard great things about the Lumix G 20mm f1.72 lens, but I already own the f1.7 25mm. Is that extra 10mm of effective width worth the purchase?
So you have the 20 millimeter, right?
I do.
And you like that lens a lot, right?
Love it. Great lens. Use it a ton when I shot weddings, especially.
So I have the 25 millimeter f1.4. I don't have the f1.7. It's actually one of the most reasonably priced lenses in the Lumix lineup. I think it's only like $160 or something. That might be with the current
discount.
The
20 millimeter is?
The 25mm. The 25mm is actually cheaper than the 20.
Gotcha.
But it's a bigger lens. It's like a normal sized prime lens.
Oh, it's not a pancake.
Millimeter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your lens is tiny.
Yeah, do I have it? I don't have it nearby.
And it's... I just even played around with one of my... I took out my 12 to 35mm lens, and I played around with the difference between 20 and 25. And It's a pretty small difference. I mean, it's noticeable, but... it's probably the equivalent of you just backing up 2 inches from your subject.
Yeah, maybe I think if you have a 25 millimeter lens and you're looking to spend some money on another lens, I wouldn't get one so close unless you really have already fleshed out your ultra wides and your telephoto lenses. But there's probably a better lens that you could get to kind of make yourself more well rounded.
Yeah, it's also funny because for a second I thought, I know I've had a pancake lens that had. It always seemed to me that those were pretty good at focusing close, their minimum focal length or distance.
Mm-hmm.
So I compared the two, and I think it's like 7.5 inches on the 20 millimeter, and it's like 9.5 inches on the 25 millimeter. So you can get slightly closer to your subject with the 20 millimeter, just barely, but it's about the distance that like the difference in framing makes. So you'd pretty much be getting the same shots.
The same shot.
Yeah, so I don't really think you would need both.
That's funny.
So here's a Twitter message we got from Jesse in London, and he's asking about the MKH416 Sennheiser microphone that he's been using it while he's at university, and he is totally in love with this thing. And he's wondering if we've used it, and if we think it makes sense to get for interviews. I have not used this microphone. I don't think you have.
Nope.
It's like a shotgun, but I think it's more like one of those, it's like a great sort of sound engineer boom mic sort of mic. And actually this microphone, we've heard about this before because our friend Matt Shivers, the voiceover artist, talks about this lens or this mic. He loves this mic. It's like his favorite one. But do you see how much this one costs?
$999.00. It is $1,000.
Yeah. I mean,
it's an expensive mic.
Yeah. So I told him, like, you may love this thing, and if you really do love it, yeah, maybe you should pick one up. But I just don't know if I could love any microphone that much when, like, I've used $200 microphones that I've been really happy with as well. I think any microphone, if you can get it close, it's going to sound pretty good.
Yeah, I'm sure there are times when it's appropriate, but when we're trying to stay as inexpensive as possible, that's just a little too much for me.
Yeah. Hey, we almost skipped one question by accident.
Uh-oh.
Facebook message from Bryce.
Did I skip it? Who was it that skipped it? You or me?
It was me. It was my fault.
Oh, was it really? I was certain it was going to be my fault.
This is a question about frame rates in the timeline. When you make a project in Final Cut Pro 10, there's an option to make it 30 frames per second or 29.97. Or you can also do 24p, or you can do 23.98. So which to choose when you're editing?
I feel like we've covered this before, and I still don't remember the answer.
Well, let's start with, why would you ever choose 30 exactly versus 29.97? Like, where does 29.97 come from?
Yeah, Griffin, tell me.
It's the weird, like, NTSC standard. I mean, that's what television is. Television is 29.97. And actually, almost everything I shoot in 24 frames, I'm actually shooting 23.98. That's when I'm in the NTSC setting on my GH5, I'm shooting 23.98. So pretty much if you're shooting in the US, you're shooting the NTSC standard, and you'll be shooting one of those kind of weird numbers. And I forget exactly. It has to do with, like, audio and electricity, and I don't even remember exactly why we came to those numbers, but it just, the fact is, those are the numbers that we use.
Those are the numbers.
Whereas, like, actual cinema, I'm sure if you're shooting a real movie in Hollywood, you're shooting it in exactly 24.00 frames per second. Ultimately, these two versions look the same. There could be a slight issue if you're editing them together. Over time, you might get some lag, but ultimately there's not a big difference. I would just try to pick the frame rate in your timeline that matches the frame rate that you actually shot in your camera.
And so if you're using a US consumer camera, you probably want the weird decimal ones. If you're not, than go with the round numbers.
Yeah. And if you don't know, you can actually just tell Final Cut to use automatic settings, I think is how it's phrased, where the first thing that you put in the timeline will make...
It sets it all.
The project settings. So just drop in your first clip that's a normal clip from your camera, and it should make it 4K 23.98 if that's what you shot. But it's always better to edit what you shoot, because then I think if you pick like a different resolution or a different frame rate, now Final Cut will start rendering everything, because it's saying this shot doesn't match the project settings. I need to transcode it or render it to make it match. So it's just more work.
We did it.
Well, that's it. We did it.
Unless you got any more secret questions that I skipped over.
No. I was like messing with the order while we were doing it.
Yeah, and while I was reading one, the whole screen moved, which was great. But I think I handled it with aplomb. So thank you for making it a little more difficult to read a question.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't be fun if there were no challenges. I was just introducing drama into the podcast.
That's right. We could draw a story circle about that.
All right, well, we'll be back next Wednesday with more of your filmmaking questions and more discussion of stuff like this.
Stuff like this. And maybe a hashtag Ask Griffin question if anyone sends one in.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Cool.
Twitter, hashtag Ask Griffin. Bye, everybody. We'll talk to you later.
Bye. Including the new Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 4K. Let me say that one more time.
You want to start over all the way?
Yeah, I want to do that. Including the new Blackmagic... I don't know why I can't say that.